You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and as usual, this is our weekly roundup of the news, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call John T. Bennett, also their chief White House correspondent, and as Alec Baldwin once said in a movie, it's been an interesting 24 hours. So we'll be talking a little bit about what's going on in the Middle East in the last couple of days. Joe Biden is catching up in the polls with Donald Trump. At the same time, Donald Trump begins his trial on Monday in Manhattan. There's the horrible state of the Biden Communications Department. We've talked about that many times. The abortion issue is coming back around into the presidential race. And Marjorie Taylor Greene still says she wants to displace and get rid of Michael Johnson, Speaker of the House. So we have that and a whole lot more. So stick around. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Questions, Just Ask the Press, and we're just going to ask some questions. As like I said at the beginning, you know, as Alec Baldwin said in The Hunt for Red October, it's been an interesting 24 hours. Iran seized a cargo ship in the Suez, launched drones at Israel. Joe Biden, the president, left early and came back to the White House yesterday afternoon, spoke with the King of Jordan and the G7, and has spoken repeatedly about what's gone on, and has also cheered the efforts of U.S. fighter pilots and, of course, the actions in Israel from Israeli defense forces to make sure that there was little or no damage from the drones fired from Iran. But there is no doubt this is an escalation of what's been going on in the Middle East, and Joe Biden still isn't talking too much about it. I will say off the top, I did ask John Kirby today if we have any idea what's in that container ship that was seized by Iran, and so far, no news there as to what's in it. With that, John, your thoughts?
Yeah, pretty dramatic stuff yesterday and last night. I was at a local nursery buying things for the garden, and, you know, glanced at my phone and saw the president was coming back from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, where he and the first lady have a beach home. He was coming back in the afternoon, and that was a pretty good indication that as legendary pro wrestling announcer Jim Ross would say, business was damn sure about to pick up. And boy, did it last night. Biden in the Situation Room with the National Security Team. The gang was all there. And as you said, Iran. What began as talk about what seemed like a relatively small attack with drone aircraft coming first, it seemed at the start like Iran was signaling, okay, we'll send, you know, these slow-moving drones, you know, everybody's radars and everything's going to light up, so you're going to see this coming, that this was more of a message than anything. But we found out this morning, Eastern time, once the Israelis and the U.S. and the Brits were also involved with fighter aircraft, that there were over 300 drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles fired from Iranian soil, and this is significant for, obviously it's significant because they're shooting at Israel, but it's unprecedented that Iran has never directly attacked Israel from its own soil until last night. So tensions are high. The Israelis at least are floating that they're not looking for a wider war. White House officials, I don't know, Brian, if you were on the call earlier, yes, Sunday as we tape, with some national security officials on background. They basically confirmed that President Biden told Prime Minister Netanyahu in a Saturday night phone call while the attack was ongoing not to retaliate for what was Iranian retaliation for Israel on April 1st, killing a top Quds Force, Revolutionary Guard Quds Force general of Iran in Damascus, Syria. They attacked a diplomatic facility and killed several other people as well. So it doesn't take long to see how this could spin wildly out of control, get very bloody, and go on for a long time.
Let so me Biden stop right there for a second.
Yeah, Biden and company are trying to de-escalate this. And I think that's part of the reason. Sorry, Brian, I know you got a question. I think that's part of the reason we haven't heard from the president yet as of Sunday night. I think he's working it hard behind the scenes, back channeling, trying to keep what's left of the lid on this thing.
Yeah, you and I will probably be in the White House tomorrow and probably find out if he has a statement to make. But I want to turn to you, Michael, because you and I are both of an age that can remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I got to tell you, what's happened in the last 24 hours, I don't know if it's my age or if I'm looking at it, logically, but to me, this is the scariest time, I think, since I was a young kid. And it seems like we're closer to an all-out war in the Middle East and maybe World War III than we've been in many, many years.
Well, it depends on how the parties react. If the cooler heads prevail and we can de-escalate, then, sort of like with the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have this tick up in anxiety and then cooler heads prevail and we return to some level of normalcy. The problem here is, and I think Tom Friedman was writing about it in the Times today, that you really can't return to the same status quo. Somehow, Iran has to be more thoroughly isolated. It can't be that everyone says, all right, we call it even. You shot at us, we shot at you. Now let's go back to this, sort of Cold War proxy war. Something, I think, more significant has to change in the dynamic among the countries, especially perhaps with China, to see, if there's a way in which there can be some new paradigm that further isolates Iran and, sort of limits Israel's desire for further retaliation. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think something has to be done to reset the balance of relations between Iran and the other countries in the world, economically or otherwise. Because if it does escalate militarily, then that's a big problem.
Yeah, we're screwed, blued, and tattooed. And John, I guess that takes me back to, I don't know that we have, I have more faith in Biden in this particular case because of his experience on the international scene to do the right thing. I don't know that I have faith that we can report it accurately. We have kind of messed up the Middle East so far since the Hamas war began. I don't know that. How do you look at it that way? Do you think that we'll get the word out correctly?
That's a tough one. You're going to get the version of it from, conservative media is going to tell a different story, sadly.
Yes.
Than the rest of us. I noticed yesterday as I was getting alerts on my phone as the attack was getting underway that of the alerts I got, and it's also telling about this media environment that I'm talking about alerts and not stories, because I was going off the alerts while I was doing some weekend stuff. And, I noticed that only the New York Times noted in their alerts that this was a retaliatory attack. I noticed even by Friday You mentioned Admiral Kirby. He did a press call on Friday. And one thing that I think has gotten lost in the coverage and in our questioning is the fact that just that this was retaliatory, even though to think that what the Iranians did last night was proportional to one general being taken out, is just a laughable concept. I mean, just they talk about overkill. That was not a rational response by any means. But I do think it bears more questioning here about the events of the first week of April. We know that President Biden had a tense phone call where he read the Riot Act to Benjamin Netanyahu, told him to change course in Gaza in a number of ways. Well, I think now we have to wonder if the events of April 1st, which was when the Quds commander, the Iranian general, was taken out by the Israelis, I think we need to question Kirby and others this week on, you know, whether that frustrated Biden. Was they've talked about this, quote, growing frustration, end quote, that Biden's had with Netanyahu. And I got to wonder now if taking out the general also got under Biden's skin, if he thought that was a provocation that maybe didn't need to happen right then. And then, yeah, of course, you had the World Central Kitchen food aid workers that were taken out. The Israelis say it was a mistake. Chef Jose Andres, who heads right. that organization, says it was not a mistake, that they knew, the Israelis knew exactly what they were doing. And then you have Biden on the phone with Netanyahu. So that's what I would like to get at more of that this week. And I just, you know, we're going to cover this thing like a ball game. And that yes. never plays well.
No. And I don't know. I hope cooler heads, calmer minds, and some wisdom prevails, because it's going to be a very interesting week, beginning with Monday. And speaking of Monday and interesting weeks, what a way to pivot. Michael, I guess I'll have you catch us up on the Donald Trump trial that's beginning today, Monday, in Manhattan.
Well, Monday begins jury selection, which is a critical part of the process. They need to find 12 jurors who are willing to follow the evidence and the legal instructions that the judge gives them at the end of the evidentiary presentation and render a verdict based on that without politics interfering with their judgment. This process of selecting a jury will take a couple of weeks, would be my guess, because it's very hard to wean out people with predispositions on either side. But that's what the process is intended to do when it works best. And I think that it will be interesting to see whether or not Donald Trump stays in the courtroom, or whether he asks for some sort of waiver to not have to be there. Normally, criminal defendants have to be in court during the their trials. I've never had a defendant obtain a waiver from being there, you know, for an hour or two here and there, a doctor's appointment. Sometimes a case will get delayed, or the defendant will say, you know, I'm okay with my lawyer proceeding with this thing, but it'll be interesting to see what Donald Trump does in respect of his, you know, his willingness to be in the courtroom, because this trial, if you pick a jury in a week or two, and it takes a couple of more weeks to try it, you know, you're talking about a month or more time where he essentially is quiet from 9:30 to 4:30, except when the court takes a break and he comes outside and he gives his, you know, prepared persecution witch hunt remarks. There's no trials on Wednesday, so he has Wednesday to hit the campaign trail or whatever else he wants to do. But we're at a very critical stage in any trial where it's
Could
a high publicity. I think it's probably within the judge's discretion to give him a waiver. I mean, there are extenuating circumstances. The guy is running for president. And so, you know, there's you as a defendant have a right to, you know, confront and cross-examine your accusers. And that's normally the reason why defendants want to be in the courtroom. So as witnesses are saying things about them, they can lean over to their lawyer and say whatever they want to say. If he's not there, it's hard to do that. I don't think he's the type of defendant who at the end of the day will come back and then read, you know, 500 pages of trial transcript, assuming they can get a day.
I don't think they read a 3x5 card, but that's another matter.
Same day return. So that's where we're up to. All the motions to dismiss have been ruled on and the case is going forward. All of the motions to disqualify the judge or delay seem to have been satisfied. I'm sure there'll be some 11th and a half hour effort to postpone one more time. But barring success, it will be a trial on Monday with, and the way it'll work, I think, is that each side, numbers of jurors will come in, prospective jurors. There's a 42 question questionnaire that each juror, prospective juror, will be asked about, which each of those 42 questions have sub questions. It could take, you know, half an hour or so per
to answer those.
Yeah, per prospective juror. Then after all the answering of the, like, the first pool, then they have the ability the lawyers do to strike for cause, meaning that there's a conflict that would preclude the person from being on the jury. I'm related to the defendant. My wife works for Trump Hotels. You know,
I'm a reporter.
I'm a reporter who has a preconceived notion of the right evidence. And then after the for cause challenges are made, then they have the peremptory challenges. You have to just watch Curb Your Enthusiasm to see how that plays out, because I think that was in this last season. But peremptory challenges are challenges that lawyers get to make for essentially any reason except for those which are protected: race, class,
and how many
gender.
Of those
get? I think they're getting 12. Right. 10 or 12 peremptory challenges. And for cause, I think for causes is 12, and then peremptories are 10. But I don't know if they're going to do that across the whole jury selection process or per the tranches of prospective jurors that they bring in. I just don't know yet the mechanics of it. But 12 for cause, 10 peremptories. And as I said, peremptories, as long as it's not race, class, you know, some protected status. It could be the guy's got a blue shirt. I hate blue shirts. The guy is skinny. I hate skinny people. Vice versa with heavy people, tall people, short people, people who come from this side of the track, that side of the track. Everyone has different theories of how they select juries. When I was trying
with chicken pox.
Well, you know, contagious diseases might be a for cause basis. But when I was a lawyer selecting juries, knowing sort of my irreverence as a person generally, and, you know, sort of tendency to make snarky, sarcastic remarks. You guys have never seen that.
I've never seen you do that, Michael. John, I've never witnessed that at all.
Not once.
No.
I try to behave myself on this show, given its sobriety.
Why?
That makes one of us.
But but so because of that, I would purposefully make some sort of comment that I knew would come out spontaneously in the course of the trial. I would do it purposefully in the jury selection process and see who grimaced and who smiled. And I would, my pretty much principal criterion for selecting, for using my peremptories, was I got rid of the frowners. Yeah. If they didn't like me, you know, if they thought, yeah, oh my God, you know, another, you know, dad joke. If that was what the reaction I was getting, I would have a hard time connecting with them. And of course, as a lawyer, that's the most important part of your job, is connecting with the jury. So that's how I, that was one of the bases by which I elected my peremptories. And people have different theories, and there's a whole science of jury selection, where you hire jury selection experts and you do mock trials and you see if the guy from the left side of the tracks is more inclined to vote than the right side of the tracks person. I don't know whether in this case jury selection experts have been retained, but it'll be a very interesting process. Which we won't get to see. The jury is going to be sequestered and anonymous.
Yeah.
And even the sketch artist is not allowed to draw pictures of prospective jurors. So they're doing their very best to protect the perspective, and then of course the actual jurors.
And with all of that said, we've gone through that whole process. How long do you think this trial will take? A month?
What I've been reading is 1 to 2 weeks for jury selection, 4 to 6 weeks for trial.
Okay. John, before we go to break, I guess I'll give you the last word on this. Is there any doubt that Donald Trump, even if he is in court, is going to use this to campaign?
Everything's a campaign. Everything is the campaign, I should say. So this will be a campaign, one long campaign event for him. Excuse me. We know the cameras will be not far away with reporters, yes, and microphones. And so he'll come out, I would expect, maybe some days, multiple times, and go on and on about the trial. But he'll also hit some talking points about, his nickname, Crooked Joe Biden, this, and persecution, that, and election interference. So, yeah, he'll use this to campaign. They'll use this to raise money. The Washington Post had a pretty good story, I believe it was late last week or last weekend, about how Trump himself wants to catch up to Joe Biden and the DNC on fundraising. As of last week, he and the RNC, the Republican National Convention, were down $100 million. Yeah, and that's a lot of money. And you know, 30-second ads and digital ads and TikToks and all of the things that they do now aren't free. So he knows he needs to make up that money. He also needs to raise more money for his many legal defenses, and he'll use this first trial to do that.
Can I make one comment before we go to break, which John triggered me when you said, will he make this a campaign rally? And I think John's answer is actually spot on, of course. But the question that will be interesting to observe is, will Donald Trump testify? Because he has said he would testify. Mm. He says that all the time and never testifies. But he's been really saying it a lot lately in respect of this trial. And so it'll be something that I would be interested in seeing how that plays out. I would guess he won't testify because he doesn't have much of a defense on the facts. He may have some legal. He may have some legal
to the facts.
Right. He may have some legal appellate arguments that are viable. Factually, it's a harder case to defend, and I'm not sure what good he does himself by testifying, especially because the testimony won't be public. So it's not a cameras in the courtroom where they can see him rail against the machine. It'll be behind closed doors, where the only thing that matters is how does it bear on his guilt or innocence?
Yeah. Well, I will. And so we'll go to a break. But I will say there are five words that come to mind if Donald Trump testifies in this case: hoisted by his own petard. And with that, we'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, for the weekly edition of Just Ask the Press, as we discuss the week's events in review. As always, with us is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor at large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. When we left, guys, we were talking about the Trump trials and, of course, what went on in the Middle East. And this week, Biden is catching up in the polls, according to polls. He is starting to gather some traction, but we still do not hear from him very often. And there have been quite a few missteps among his communication staff, with reporters telling me, among other things, that they're a little bit smug, ignorant, and elitist, members of the communication staff. And that, you know, I myself was there when there was a mistake made about, you know, the Francis Scott Key Bridge being called the Francis Scott King Bridge. And somebody looked over at me, James Rosen, I think, had said something. And I went, you know, full animal house there and just said, forget it. She's rolling. There continues to be a problem with communication, even as he's catching up in the polls. What the hell can he do?
I think I mentioned this to you last week. This is something that blew me away, and it really speaks to the communications and press shops, and Martha Kumar, our favorite professor, taught me that the comm shop and the press shop are two different things. So, but they both have flaws. And last week in her open on, was there a Thursday? I forget which day it was. When O.J. Simpson passed away. So in her open, the press secretary, Corinne Jean-Pierre, as all press secretaries do, they have something, a message they want to get out that day. And she chose to tout a gun safety rule that President Biden had signed and that had gone into effect. He did it with his executive actions. And then at the end of the first exchange, as custom, she had called on a reporter from the Associated Press. And with her last question, this reporter asked if President Biden had any thoughts about Mr. Simpson's death, whether they ever, you know, did they know each other? Did they ever run into each other? And Jean-Pierre, to my astonishment, and I all but flipped over my desk. I couldn't believe it. A gentleman who served 9 years in prison of a 33-year sentence for armed robbery
with an illegally purchased weapon.
She sent, you know, condolences to the family and talked just a little bit about Mr. Simpson. And I just thought that sums it up perfectly. She doesn't even realize that she's contradicting her open because the man was convicted on gun charges. That's part of the counts there that there were conspiracy, armed robbery, and there was another that slips my mind at the moment. But he, in part, served time in prison for armed robbery. And you just talked about a gun safety rule. And to me, it just sums up the whole operation. And once or twice, sometimes multiple times a day, you know, they get times wrong. People don't see this, but, you know, we get press advisories for calls about, you know, gun safety rule or the preview of the president's travel, stuff like that. And they get the times of those wrong. They get the dates wrong. They just sent something out a few minutes ago, for instance. It was a statement from the president. They did a call earlier today about something about the Chips and Science Act. You know, they're doling out the money now. They forgot to embargo. Everything was embargoed. They send the statement out. Then they have to send another email that the statement was also embargoed. So they start, and I can tell you that other journalists are now commenting to me that don't cover the White House that I work with to coordinate our coverage internally. They're commenting to me. They're asking me, what's going on over there? So, yeah, this is a thing. And this is not the time for these mistakes because, you know, mistakes have a way of the they accumulate and they get bigger and bigger. We've all had a bad run here and there, just in life or at work. And, you know, this is not a good trend over there. And, you know, you've got folks like John Kirby and a couple others who don't usually trip up, but others do. And I don't know if the president is even aware that these issues exist.
And that's an issue, I think. Michael, what's it look to you? What does it look like to you from the outside?
Well, we've talked about this innumerable times, and I think that Joe Biden is doing himself a disservice by not being more public. And I think that the Iran-Israel conflict has the opportunity to show an experienced international president working to protect world security, peace. And I understand that in situations like this, sometimes you just, as much as your political people might be saying, let's, you know, get out there and take advantage of this, your military and diplomatic and other advisors are saying, we can't. We have to be, you know, sort of quiet in our diplomatic efforts to scale that back. And so I get that there's a tension there, but I'm hoping that one, he de-escalates. He's able to participate in a process that de-escalates. And I think, as I said, further isolate Iran economically, and that would involve some sort of opportunity to work more closely with China. And I think then he needs to come on the air and explain what he's done and how this old man with a bad memory, according to the special counsel, has done an excellent job in bringing us away from the brink of something terrible.
I would say, man, at the end of the day, John, you know as well as I do from being there, the mistakes do mount up, and it's never been more important for a president to be seen. As I said at the beginning, I think this is one of the most tense times internationally that the United States has been through in at least the last 20 years. And probably since I was, you know, a child, this is no nonsense. It's a time for serious minds and serious actions. And I think it behooves the president of the United States to come out and speak to us. He's never been in the briefing room. He doesn't speak from the Oval that much, not in the East Room. I mean, you were there for his last so-called press conference. It was a bilat, and, you know, how long did it last? Maybe 20 minutes? I mean, in
yeah,
the heat
half
sink
hour.
Of the, yeah. Yeah, in the heat sink of oh,
it was a heat
the Rose Garden.
So we were out there before longer. They had an issue with the translation system, and they had to repair that. Another mistake. I heard one staffer snap at another, you know, didn't you bleeping check this earlier?
But they were translating. They were translating into English for you and Brian.
Yes. From Martian.
From England. From England. Yeah.
Right. We were out there longer as they sort this. Was that?
I said he's never snarky. Where do we get that from?
I have no idea.
Someone else said it's ventriloquists around me. I'm telling you.
Right. You were hacked.
Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah. So we were out there longer as they fixed their equipment than the president and the Japanese prime minister. Certainly, we're answering questions because another thing about the 2-2 format, as they call it, the opening statements are very lengthy, and especially, other than Angela Merkel, I can't remember at least being there, especially in the heat sink, because you remember them. It's so hot out there, and you're in business attire. Other than Angela Merkel, can't remember a pithy foreign leader opening statement. They go on and on and on and on.
No.
But the point I wanted to make was I thought we would hear and needed to hear from from President Biden tonight. We're taping on Sunday evening, yes, right now. He ordered American planes and warships and American reconnaissance aircraft and personnel in the region to shoot down projectiles, weapons directly from Iran. That is a huge deal. I believe he's the first U.S. commander in chief to ever give that order. So we needed to hear from him, I think, tonight. And look, a lot of Americans like me are in front of their televisions right now watching the end of the Masters golf tournament. So he had a natural lead in for, you know, an 8:30, 9 o'clock, even 8 p.m. Eastern address from the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. I just think it's like Michael said, a huge missed opportunity.
Well, and as
and his duty, it's his duty.
Yes,
and don't just do it tomorrow in a pool spray in the Oval, which
or a couple of questions tossed at him from the pool spray. I mean, what did we get today? While we've been on the air talking today, we got a statement from the president on the CHIPS Act.
Yeah,
and then we got an advisory of his trip Tuesday and Wednesday to Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Right.
I'm sorry, but when the international tensions are as they are, it behooves the president of the United States to get out in front of the people. And this is regardless of what you think of him versus Donald Trump. I understand.
Same,
that
I agree.
Those are people who are going to go, oh, well, you never held Trump. Yeah, we held Trump to these standards. We couldn't get that SOB to shut up. I mean, he'd go out and do chopper talk for a half hour. He didn't like being in the briefing room, but he did it during his last year, damn near every day during COVID. I would like to see this president. These are important times, and don't want to be interacting with a 22 or 23 or 24 or 25-year-old press, staffer asking these questions, or even with Karine Jean-Pierre. This needs to be the president speaking about these issues, even as he's coming up in the polls. It would behoove him to speak bluntly about what's going on.
It's in the job description. It's a central part of the job description. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and so with that, we're going to take another short break, and we come back, take a look at some of the things that are fueling those rising poll numbers. And of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene saying she's disgusted with giving aid to Ukraine and wants to get rid of Michael Johnson. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. With me, as always, for our weekly look into the news of the week, Just Ask the Press, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. Thanks, guys. And when we left, we were talking about the horrible state of the Biden communication effort, while he still seems to be rising in the polls. Well, one of the things that is causing the rise, if you talk to people out in the states, in voting land, as I have, is the abortion issue. It's starting to once again get some traction outside of the White House. And of course, it also didn't help Trump's cause that while he's taking credit for, you know, rebuking Roe v. Wade, you had the thing that happened in Arizona with eliminating all abortion, a court going back to an 1864 law to ban nearly all abortion, with members of Congress and even Fox television news hosts saying, hey, if you got to hop on a bus to go get an abortion, gee, that's, you know, there are worse things. I would like them to have to hop on a bus to go get their ED medication, but that's a different issue entirely. this issue, I don't know that they fully understand how people are. I mean, more than 70% of the people in this country value a woman's right to choose. Michael, is there anything that my question to you is, look, the reversal of Roe v. Wade is one thing. Going back to an 1864 law seems to me to be another.
Yeah. And interestingly, Donald Trump, the champion of I got rid of Roe v. Wade, says the Arizona decision may have gone too far. But the Republicans in Arizona elected office refused to bring the matter forward, as Democrats had been asking for a very long time. So you've got Arizona, and you also got Florida, right? Didn't the Florida Supreme Court just issue a ruling that cleared the way for a 6-week abortion ban?
Right.
So it's interesting because Trump has said recently, did he not, that he would not favor a federal ban, and that it's a state's
rights issue.
Well, that's got to be sort of contrary to the base of his Christian coalition. So I don't know how they're trying to play this, but it seems clear that this issue, both in Arizona and in Florida, and I think nationally, could be very important for the Democrats. However, of course, Hispanic voters are not so liberal when it comes to
they're
abortion.
Very devout Catholics.
Right. And so, you know, their Democratic Party is beginning to hemorrhage Hispanics as voters. It's not as monolithic. You know, it used to be that Florida was different because they were from Cuba and they come from a different history. But now, you know, if you look at the numbers, the Republicans have many more Hispanic votes than they used to. And so it's hard to see. It's a very complicated calculus, this. But short term, I think that the Democrats are advantaged by abortion being, or, you know, free choice being top of people's minds. Because clearly the Democrats got some bad economic news the other day when inflation ticked up a bit and the stock market tanked a bit. And the thought is that Jay Powell and the Fed may now further delay interest rate cuts. None of that was helpful to Biden, who gets these terrific job numbers, but gets, you know, lousy inflation numbers. And
but that to me is all a matter of communication problems. Again, when you have an administration that asks the top of the, you know, the richest people in the corporations to pay their fair share in taxes, and the response is greedflation, I think it's just a matter of messaging for the president to say, look, this isn't any of my policies. This is greedy people who don't want to pay their fair share making you pay more. And, you know, they have price gouging is the problem, not inflation. But that's just me. John, I guess my question to you in regards to what Michael's saying is, look, this abortion issue coming back is also fueling the rising numbers in the polls. And to Michael's point, will the inflation numbers negate it?
Well, that is the $4 trillion question. I think it's remarkable that these you know, very conservative ideologues on courts and you know, in state legislatures in red states continue to take this sledgehammer, this political sledgehammer, out of their tool shed and pound themselves in the knee with it. I mean that in the Sopranos Godfather way of getting kneecapped, but in this, they're self kneecapping themselves.
It's a tough room.
Because, yeah, exactly. Because this is not popular with the people. And guess who votes? The people. Yeah. And, you know, this is even majorities of Republicans want there to be access to these procedures. And, you know, when you're reaching back to the Civil War era to get this yeah. done, you know, I think that is that I know it hands the Democrats an easy attack line, an easy message going into November. And I have to say, I watched Vice President Harris on Friday, I guess it was afternoon in Arizona. She has been put at the forefront of this message for the Biden-Harris campaign. And I have to say, and I've been critical, like most folks on the beat of the vice president, she is very effective. Her stump speech on abortion access is very good. She's passionate about it. You know, she goes into prosecutor mode at one point. I've watched a couple of these now, these speeches, and it connects. And it's always good for a politician when what you're saying connects in the room. And yeah. she really connects with these audiences over this. And I expect to see them have her out and about as much as possible. And they put that trip together really quickly. We've all heard stories. I know, Brian, you and I probably heard things. I've heard things about her Senate days. We've heard things about her vice president's
office. Oh, I've covered it. I was the yeah. pool reporter on a couple of events.
So you've seen it.
Very unorganized.
Yeah, you've seen it. And this has always dogged her. But they got her out there really fast between her office and the campaign. And I would expect to see a lot more of that. And she could end up being something of a secret weapon.
Yeah. That brings, we were talking about communication earlier, but yeah, I saw her at an event in LA and it looked like, you know, a ward healer from a city council. They had it so disorganized. I had one question as the pooler. They brought her out. They took the question. She was eye level with us, 5 feet away. There was no lights. It was in a warehouse. It looked like she was running for city council. But to that point, when the president showed up at the bridge collapse, and I was there for that, there were more reporters there than there were, you know, people there, you know, audience members. He had to encourage them to cheer. The staging was poor. They had to rearrange people on the stage during it. The stage was flat on the ground, on wet ground. They brought him through a parking lot.
That's what I noticed. I was watching remotely, thanks to our friends at C-SPAN.
Yeah, it was like a mayor thing. The president of the United States.
When he came out. If
that had been Donald Trump, there would have been this huge stage, right. Red, white, and blue, band. They'd had spot. There were two lights. Donald Trump had more lights if he was indoors. And that's the thing that gets me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, we Politico and Axios, I believe, folks can look it up, have had stories in some of their newsletters about the what's called the White House Advance Team, and they do exactly what is in their name. They go ahead of the president and plan his travel. You know, they pick where the stage is going to go, or they bring him options, and then he decides, or his right. you know, chief of staff or whoever decides. But they're the ones doing the planning on the ground. They're picking the venues. You know, they are the ones who picked that site in Baltimore, and it was not the best option from
it
what I've been told.
It was not staged well. It was horrible.
It was not staged well. You know, as someone who wrote a story that afternoon, and I'm sure you did too, Brian, and then looking through one of the wire photo services trying to find a good one, it wasn't easy. And, you know, that's on the advanced team. And,
that's putting it lightly. You're being kind.
You know, I didn't even find one from the staging of it. I used one of a pool photo from a pool photographer from Getty from Marine One. I'm sorry, from the press Osprey of Marine One flying over the wreckage. So I couldn't even find a good one of the president on the stage with all the officials. So I went with that one. And Marine One is just cool. So I chose that one.
So I have a question for you guys. We were talking earlier about Biden has a slight uptick in the polls lately. And that's from the New York Times Siena poll that was just released. And what I'm looking at, and I was wondering if you guys have studied it some, is they asked the question, if a presidential election were held today and the candidates were Biden and Trump, they're essentially tied, 45 for Biden, 46 for Trump, with Trump getting most of his votes from a non-college white people in the 45 to 64 range. No, that's normative stuff. But then they asked the next question, if the presidential, so that was just Biden, Trump, don't know or refused, which was at 8%. So 45, 46, 8% don't know or refused. Then they open it up and they say, if it were held today and it was Biden, Trump, Robert Kennedy Jr., and then Jill Stein, Cornel West, somebody else, it's 40 Biden, 42 Trump. And so it's what do you guys make of this, that Bobby Kennedy Jr., Robert Kennedy Jr., I don't know what he calls himself, is polling at 2% and the others are less than 0.5%. Do you have a sense yet of who is, if Kennedy hangs in there and has some, you know, staying power when it gets right up to the day of the election? Because a lot of these guys just falter right before when people realize that voting for them is symbolic, but not useless, necessarily helpful. Are you guys seeing stuff in your beat about the impact of Robert Kennedy's Jr.'s impact on the
race? I'll ask you this. Who do you think is most likely to vote for Robert Kennedy Jr.?
Well,
who is an anti-vaxxer. I know that the feeling, and he has been pushed out there by those who support Donald Trump, thinking that he will take away from Biden. But I honestly think that there may be some more disaffected Trump voters who would be enticed to vote for him rather than Joe Biden. John?
Yeah, wait. Can I just ask you this before John answers? I had that same instinct, but as I look at the numbers, and you guys can pull it up if you want to.
Right.
And you ask, by race
right.
and education.
I know where he's going with this. He's
by
right.
race and yeah. education, the highest percentage that Kennedy has is 3, and that's college educated people. That is not necessarily your anti-vaxxer.
What that shows is while the Republican Party and Donald Trump have the market cornered on conspiracy theories, they don't have a monopoly on it. And that there is thinking along those lines of people who lean to the left. I mean, Brian has talked to him. I'm sure we all know folks like that. You know, think back to Russiagate, and then, did Russia help Trump in 2016? Adam Schiff running around talking about collusion, and then we get the Mueller report, no collusion. But people on the left still think that. So I'm not saying Robert Kennedy, believes that. That's just an example of folks on the left can fall victim to the same sorts of thinking.
Yeah.
And don't forget that those people on the left are not so far different from the very same people on the right. And I have known people who are very liberal, far left, who say they will vote for Donald Trump. So it's not cut and dry, any of them.
Yeah, that's that populism.
Yeah,
the populism that runs. Yeah. You know, it's like in national security, they call it the horseshoe, where the conservatives and liberals almost touch on issues like surveillance. I mean, we saw that last week with Section 702, for different reasons, or sometimes the same reasons, you have folks like Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders who can agree on something, or in this case, not wanting to do something.
And with that said, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, last issue of the day, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's just so disgusted with wanting to give money to Ukraine and wants to get rid of Michael Johnson. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we're back. It is Just Ask the Question, our weekly show called Just Ask the Press, where we discuss the week's events with former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent of CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. Our last issue of the day, Marjorie Taylor Greene wants to get rid of Michael Johnson. And Johnson said over the weekend that he's trying to put together an aid package for Israel. And at the same time, he's got to step lightly. He wants one for Ukrainian aid. But Greene says that she's disgusted with giving and can't understand why anybody would give aid to Ukraine. Does she understand? Obviously not. John, let you start out with that one.
Well, this is the ongoing saga of Michael and Marjorie, the speaker and the Trump ally in the House. Remember, folks, it is incorrect to say she's a member of the Freedom Caucus. They asked her to leave their club, but she still runs in circles with those folks. And she is among that group of hard right conservatives in the House that really led the charge to push out former speaker, former member of Congress now, Kevin McCarthy, that ended up with them rejecting three or four, maybe five candidates after that. And they ended up in Mike Johnson, who was not necessarily a backbencher, but he was a medium bencher.
I don't even know if he was on the bench.
he was a medium bencher. He was known to the conservatives, obviously. So instantly,
do you think they'll kick him out? Do you think she'll get him kicked out?
Well, the frustration here, I mean, all of this goes back to federal spending. That's what all of this has been about since Barack Obama was elected, and then all of a sudden here came the Tea Party, which became the Freedom Caucus. So I don't think that except for Greene and maybe a small handful of other House Republicans, that they want to go through that again and that they want to damage themselves. I talked about the political sledgehammer. Well,
they
another
could end up with Hakeem Jeffries as their speaker.
I mean, that could happen. It's a one vote majority for Republicans. So it wouldn't take much if the Democrats stuck together, and we know they would. They did last time. On every ballot, they voted for Jeffries for speaker. So, you know, there's what, 216, 217 votes. And if you got a moderate Republican from, I don't know, New York State or somewhere like that, who's very vulnerable in November in their reelection campaign, who just said, you know, to hell with this, we don't deserve the majority. Even though I think that is far-fetched to think that that any Republican would vote for Jeffries, the problem would be they themselves would not be unified on one person to become speaker. And therefore, we could just have, you know, you could have 50 ballots, you know, that you could have a 4 week, you know, they're voting 4 days a week for speaker and nothing's getting done. So, no, I don't think that they would vote to vacate the speakership again just because it's such a bad look. And even though it doesn't...
Well, that doesn't mean shit.
Right. It doesn't look like... Remember, always remember this. It doesn't look like many of them are having fun when we see them in the hallways or on TV, but it still beats a 9-to-5.
Yeah,
they want to get reelected. And it would definitely hurt them. I don't think members of Congress can poll much lower than they do now anyway. But, you know, my congressman tends to poll better than your congressman, if you know what I mean. So they want to get reelected, and it would be a terrible look. But that doesn't mean, however, that she won't decide on her own to force the vote to vacate. And I think it, I think for some House Republicans, it would be a tough decision because, again, this is all about federal spending. And what's frustrated Green and other conservatives is Johnson has done just what Boehner and Paul Ryan did and Kevin McCarthy. He struck deals on big, huge spending packages with the White House and House and Senate Democrats. And they don't contain the kinds of big cuts or policy conservative policy riders that these folks just believe they're entitled to. There is no other way to explain it at this point. They believe by definition, because they are conservatives, that it's right and it's righteous and it, all this stuff should be in the bills. But that doesn't apply to the Democrats or any moderate member of the Republican conference, just them. And that's simply that's simply not how it works. So I believe she could just get upset one day and she can force the vote by making the motion privileged in the House. She can force the vote. Okay. She hasn't done that yet. She introduced it, but she didn't ask for it to be considered privileged. She could just have a bad day and throw it down.
Let me interrupt you for this, because right as we're talking about this, we just got the email. President Biden convened a call this afternoon with Senate Majority Leader Schumer, Senate Minority Leader McConnell, Speaker of the House Johnson, and House Minority Leader Jeffries to discuss Iran's unprecedented attack against Israel. On the call, the president discussed the urgent need for the House of Representatives to pass the National Security Supplemental as soon as possible. So to a point that we're just taking, this is all going to come to a head in the next few days. Michael, I'll leave you last words on it.
Will Marjorie Taylor Greene buck Donald Trump is the question, because he clearly does not want this, because I think he understands that more chaos in the House threatens the majority Republican House next time around. And so I think he or someone who was advising him have said to him, this is not a fight that will help you. The question, and I think he's made that known. And so will Marjorie Taylor Greene, as John says, sort of like have a bad day or have something just irk her and say the hell with it at the, you know, sort of to the displeasure of the former president. That'll be a very interesting thing to watch.
It's going to be, look, I mean, with the trial, with everything going on in Iran and with this in Congress, this is going to be a hell of a week, folks.
It's going to be a hell of a week. And one serious note and then one not so serious note. This could come to a head with, I don't expect the House to pass the Senate's supplemental. I think it'll be a different bill. It may or may not have some aid for Ukraine, but I believe the Senate bill has $60 billion for Ukraine. If Johnson does attach some Ukraine money, it won't be nearly that big. I believe it was 14 or so for Israel. I think that amount will be more because, you know, they fired a lot of Iron Dome and Arrow missile system munitions last night. Those have to be replenished. The one reason that those systems work so well is, you know, they just send these interceptors up they lock on.
The reason why they work so well is because we supply them with the material to make it work well.
We'll see.
If your gun's empty, it doesn't really help you to have a gun.
Yeah.
You'd be like in the movies and throw your empty gun at the enemy.
And this is going to need to be replenished quickly. So let's see how quickly Johnson can act. Not so serious note, who hasn't had a bad day and wanted to vote to vacate a coworker?
With that said, we come to the end of our hour. I want to thank you guys. And John, your turn to plug. What do you want to plug, my brother?
Oh, boy, this is going to be a busy and very consequential week for all the reasons that we just talked about. You can follow along my coverage and my colleagues at rollcall.com.
And Michael.
Again, my podcast is That Said with Michael Zeldin, talking to various thought leaders about various issues of the day. Book review coming out this Thursday is with Rachel Slade about a company in Maine called American Roots that is trying to actually manufacture apparel, 100% manufactured, 100% assembled in the United States.
Good Lord, have they lost their mind?
No, they're doing
American made.
They're actually doing it. And
there you go.
And the point to be made here is that the return of American manufacturing, as it was in the 1800s and it is today, is a national independence imperative.
And with that said, this is Just Ask the Question. I want to thank you all for joining us. I am your host, Brian Karam. You can catch us here next time. So thanks a lot and see you next time.